Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Now, Cindy, you teased me and everybody with escargot when we were setting off the last segment. So we have French bistros, and in them we prepare escargot. And the coolest thing is when you see the four-year-old, you know.
It's so exciting.
Get the snails for the first time. And they're,
and
you know.
And they eat them.
Yeah, and you know,
and
this
them.
Thing that they think they've seen in the garden.
Right.
You know, and they go bananas.
Mm-hmm.
They go just bananas.
I think that's one of the exciting things about having a restaurant like that that so many children go to is seeing them enjoy something that if it wasn't in front of them like that, they wouldn't have had that opportunity, and they think nothing of it because they love it. It's so great.
So anyway, that's anecdotal and silly, but it is one of the cool little things. So escargot in Burgundy, what's the traditional way to deal with them?
Well, first of all, I think the process of raising the snail is interesting. So I was reading about that. Basically, two small planks, maybe the planks are about a foot long. They make an upside down V in the field, and say the field is about the size of two tennis courts. And they're just rows of these wood planks. And they have tiny irrigation. I can't imagine. It's like a little tiny farm. I could just see the little tiny irrigation in there. And then they have grass growing. And the snails attach themselves to the boards. And they feed off of this.
Is there like a Lego harvester going up and down the alleys or something?
It's just so cute. I'm dying to see this in real life. I've seen photographs of it. And so they're, you know, fed. And then this kind of gets uncute. The last month of their life, they live about 6 months before they harvest. They starve them. and once because apparently snails eat everything, and that might be bad for the human that wants to eat them. So you have to starve them, and then they're cooked. And so when
this
they're
was
cooked,
such a happy story.
It was a happy story until they starved the little snails.
I was thinking of taking my child to a snail farm until you talked about the torture and death.
Well, you could maybe hide that part from her. But, you know, it's this great, I mean, you know, snails are one of the most amazing and unusual things I think you can eat. I mean, if you see them out there, you're thinking, really, do I want to eat that? But they are. They're delicious. So they cook them in basically a fortified court bouillon. So it's carrot, celery, onion, white wine, of course, from the region, water, and aromatics, bay leaf, thyme, peppercorn. It's pretty straightforward. And then they cook them for almost 2 hours. And then they would remove them from the from the shell. And there's a little vein that has to be removed. And then, typically what you would then turn around and do is you would have made your snail butter. And this is what you would do at home, put them back in the shell. And put a little butter on top and broil them or heat them in one of the traditional dishes, which is a lot more fun because then the butter goes into the little pots in the dish and you get to soak that up with your bread and your great baguette, and you've just had this amazing dish. And
your entire baguette.
That's
the comical thing.
But that snails are an important dish in that region, if you can find snails from Burgundy, they really are spectacular. So, and snails come in different sizes.
And when people buy snails, they're buying cans of snails typically. So it's really a question of who, the integrity of that provider, where they're coming from, and the quality of the snail, and also what they've actually done to prepare them.
Indeed, it's very
then,
true.
Because then you're gonna do the finishing, but 90% of it's in the
They've been
the
cooked by someone else. Yeah. Exactly, raised and cooked. So. You're right, and sometimes you can find snails in glass. It's very rare, I would love to actually try snails. They've been packed that way rather than in a tin can, but they typically come in tin. So snails, that's my favorite.
What other Burgundian food products do you think of, or recipes do you think of as being archetypal that you can't do without, that someone should master?
Well, I started talking about the black currants, and as we will have black currants here this summer, I think it's valuable to talk about using them. And they are tart. There's no other way to think of them. They're not a sweet berry. And they are a great foil for a dish that has a lot of fat, which is what magret has. So magret is the breast from the duck that is, so famous, and the Moulard duck. And when you have magret, one of the great aspects of cooking it is rendering the fat side of the breast. So you score that, which makes you make little hash marks on the skin side, and then you would cook that on very low heat on the fat side until it begins to render or reduce the amount of fat, and then begin to crisp. So that's your goal with a piece of magre, and then you would flip it over, sear it, and cook it to medium rare, medium, whichever you prefer, and to and finish it in the oven by cooking it. Why are you smiling at me right now?
Because I'm thinking about the difference between black currants and red currants.
Oh.
And I'm wondering if it's one of mood or politics.
Oh, God. Okay.
No, but seriously, if you're using red currants with the same dish, function the same way?
Yes, absolutely. I
a very tart, bright berry.
And it's just, you know, pull the little berries off and quite simply serve them with a, you know, and this may be a fun time to just use a tiny bit of cassis in your sauce if you're making pan sauce. And I would hit the pan with red wine, too, because cassis is sweet, right?
It's a little sweet.
So I would deglaze with a little bit of red wine, the pan, and hit it with the cassis, and hit it with your stock if you can make a sauce that way, and reduce it down. And oh my God, it would just be so brilliant. Maybe a little bit of walnuts on the plate, which are also traditional to Burgundy, you know, that's a great dish.
Magret has that natural bloody sweetness that it's much fattier, but almost like venison. And I also think of currants as being nice with venison because it has that same sort of natural, it's the sweetness of the blood.
Well, and you also have another product, which I talk about so often, but you know, I'll just talk about briefly because I think this is a dish that's important, which is a gratin made with truffles. So a potato gratin made with truffle, it would be thin slices of potato laid out in the dish. And you could either I prefer when I make a gratin to alternate layers with the dairy product in between each one. I've also seen it made where you do, you know, maybe four layers of potato and then you drop the cream in or butter. But I prefer do your thin slice of potato and then a little cream, salt and pepper. Then you go to your next layer. If you're putting cheese in, you know, I definitely do that every two or three layers because you don't want to over cheese it. Gruyere is a great, Comté is a great cheese to use in a gratin. But when I do truffles, I just do cream and salt and pepper and truffle. I don't put cheese in there. Right. And, you know, the truffle should be in the middle of the gratin, and that will perfume the dish.
In the middle layer. So they perfume out.
Right. Yeah. And that's a great and very traditional Burgundian dish, and that's because they can walk out their door and hunt a truffle and find it for free. I think I might have to move to Burgundy, maybe.
Well, you find it further south than you think of Burgundy as being. Like, it's not the wine-growing region of Burgundy, but more down south of Lyon, south of Valence, that you find it in the northernmost Provence. Mm-hmm. What used to be historical Burgundy, or sort of under the control of the Dukes.
Okay.
You want to take a minute and
talk about wine.
Wine, yeah.
We can't.
You're talking about all these dishes, and I'm like, lapin le moutarde, you know.
Oh, so what would you drink with that?
Well, it depends upon the richness of the sauce a little bit. If there's some reduction that's in there, mm-hmm. you know, because you can finish it as a cream sauce, or as a reduction sauce.
Yeah, I think no reduction. I think it should just be, you know, cream and the wonderful juices from the pan.
Then it's a really opulent white Burgundy. One of the famous, Chardonnay is the white grape of Burgundy. Mm-hmm. Pinot Noir is the red grape. And depending upon, and just a very quick sort of organizational thought, so you think, oh, well, it's easy because all white Burgundy is Chardonnay, all red Burgundy is Pinot Noir, they're all going to be the same, not remotely the case. Mm-hmm. The vineyards change from village to village, their exposure and their situation, what we were talking about before, terroir, and the nature, the personality of each piece of soil is going to be a little bit different in each given vintage, too. Burgundy is pretty far north to grow Pinot Noir in particular, and so it's on the edge of where you can grow red wines, and Chardonnay from there can go from being very cool climate to you know, pretty darn rich and opulent depending upon the vintage and the site. So it's funny when someone says, you know, well, that dish is that, you know, the lapin le moutarde. It really is as specific as how exactly are you seasoning it or what else is on the plate. Because if there is a strong flavor from the mustard, is it spicy? Is it, you know, I immediately start thinking, well, I want something with power, maybe Merceau, something with some breadth and richness. But which vineyard in Merceau and what vintage, you know, is going to mm-hmm. depend on the details of the dish. Maybe I want 2008, which is developed really nicely, that has a really good spine of acidity to take on the mustard that's there. Maybe I want it to be from a Premier Cru vineyard, but not a monster. Like Perrier is a monster Premier Cru vineyard. So when you see a label for a bottle of white Burgundy, it'll say Merceau, the name of the village. Mm-hmm. It'll say Les Charmes, which is another one of the Premier Crus, but not quite as robust as Perrier, meaning not quite as much alcohol and acidity and phenolic density. Mm-hmm. You know, so that I'm sort of like thinking, okay, it's sort of like thinking, I want to wear a blue necktie. Exactly which blue? What looks best with this shirt? And mm-hmm. what looks best with the suit.
Sure. Well, there's subtleties
and what reflects
in the
weather today.
Subtleties
you know
in
I mean?
The wine. I completely
that's exactly
understand,
right. So that's, the, but that's the, how you go through that process. Mm-hmm. And then it's a question of, you know, that last question of like, you know, what is the weather like today? What color am I going to like? That some of that is the nature of, you know, sometimes you're very close. The Genevrier and Charme are very similar in characteristics. The one is a little more mineral. The one is a little more citrus always. Mm-hmm. So that's... But Burgundy, as far as wine goes, is always the crazy rabbit hole because it is really only the two grapes. And then it's the variability of the site and the decision-making of the grower.
I think that's what's so interesting is when you go there and you taste the wine from, if we move from one winemaker down to the guy next door. And
from the same site.
Yeah, it's amazing, the
difference.
This
guy has four rows of Chardonnay next to this next guy's four rows of Chardonnay in the exact same vineyard. And it's decision when to harvest, when how they're pruning, how the vines are trained, exactly how many bunches they're keeping per plant, mm-hmm. What time you know when they're going to, what temperature they're going to run fermentations, how long they're going to keep it on the lees, how old the barrels are or not. One other thing to think about with Burgundy, Chardonnay, and Pinot Noir, immediately you think of, well, we grow it on the West Coast, but we tend to put it in oak barrels, and there's a big like vanilla flavor, oaky flavor on those wines, a lot of times. In Burgundy, a lot of times it doesn't show up that way because one, they don't use as many new barrels which have strong vanilla flavors and tannin, as a lot of Burgundians do, and they also on the West Coast they have more. Density, more alcoholic power. They have a lot more sunshine for those grapes, mm-hmm. for the most part, than the Burgundians do. And so it's sort of a matter of a level of seasoning for, you know, like how delicate is a product.
Right. You don't want to blow out the flavor of the wine because of the oak aging or the oak flavor.
Exactly right.
Flavor. Yeah.
It's if you're making a soup and you're going to season it with a little bit of pepper, if you're making soup from turnips that are crazy strong versus making soup with really delicate white mushrooms,
that's what I love.
Yeah, you use very different, the different hand in seasoning the soup, right?
That's why I love winemakers, because they think the way chefs think. I mean, there's a lot of them, not all of them.
The difference is when a chef makes a dish and wants to redo the dish, they can do that tomorrow. They can do it in an hour. You don't know when making wine, you don't know for, you know, if it's a Grand Cru vineyard, meaning it's one of the great, great sites in Burgundy, it's going to be 10, 15, 20 years until you know what the truth of that decision making is. How, you know, not just how did it work in the field and how did it work in the cellar, but how did it evolve? Because your work is measured when you're growing in the greatest sites, your work is measured not just in, you know, what you achieved the moment that it was made, but what you achieved over the next decade or two or three. Mm-hmm. the vineyard Corton Grancé have drunk that wine back into the 30s. And those wines are still very alive, and everyone has a different story to tell. And it's always a story of what happened that season and the decisions made by those people and how that has carried and echoed and how clear that is or is not as time has gone on in that
bottle. Well, and also you have generational changes. You have a son that may took over from a father who has a different point of view. So that's got to be the other thing that's amazing about tasting wine that, you know, as you say, from the 1930s to go through the different generations and see what their effect has been on the wine as well.
Let's take 1 second and talk about Nouvelle Cuisine. It's funny, we think about food and wine separately a lot of times. I know you and I don't, but a lot of the world, I think, does. You visit in France or in Burgundy in particular, you think of them in conjunction. When I think of Nouvelle Cuisine, which started as, you know, and I know you have fondness for exactly how this started, because it was because of all the chef-driven
good
restaurants.
Good reasons. There were good reasons, yes. Yeah. And then it turned into something else.
It turned into something almost farcical, where it's tiny little, you know, tiny little things on a plate with a little puree of something and... Mm-hmm. And no flavor there.
The whole idea behind, when people kind of get together and have something happen and they're not conscious of it, You know, it's a conscious decision on each individual's part, but it's not like Bocuse and Troyes got together and said, hey, let's come up with Nouvelle Cuisine. I mean, obviously it was a process for them, and it became something that was recognized later in hindsight. But
well, the funny thing is you don't think of Bocuse or Troyes as preparing food that is in any way not rich or flavorful.
Right.
And Nouvelle Cuisine had a reputation for being
almost like spa food or something.
Exactly.
Or just, you know. Yeah, it just went over the edge, which was such a shame.
My point about Burgundian winemakers was at the same time as Nouvelle Cuisine kind of hit on the food side and a lot of flavor came out of food, a lot of winemakers were overcompensating. It's really the only time I can think of Bourguignon, that connection of food and wine on the table not happening. And in Burgundy in the 70s and 80s, people started using a lot more new oak, and they started doing a lot of extracting of material and structure from grapes. And instead of these delicate, beautiful, haunting products, you get these things that at times after 5 years in the bottle smell like truck tires.
Can I ask, do you think there was an influence from California on that change?
I think some of the competition that was spurred by that tasting in 76 in Paris.
Yeah, yeah.
Instead of being true to what they know is the right thing to do,
they were affected by that tasting.
They were affected by that tasting, and it really affected the white wine making first and then the red wine making. It was an interesting time.
Yes, certainly.
Anyway, when we come back on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine, we'll spend a little bit more time on wine, and then we're going to get into traveling to Burgundy, places to stay, special
great
dishes
places.
And special restaurants, and all that and more on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. Thank you.